Good morning, everyone. We're all welcome, and it's lovely to see so many here. This is one of those lovely services we have a few times a year when we invite members of the congregation to share readings they have found helpful and useful. And not only will we have lovely readings, we're going to have lovely music as well and singing. So you really hit the jackpot today. Welcome to the people joining us on the web camera, and particularly welcome to Ida, my friend down in round Limerick, Tipperary area, and welcome to people who happen to listen in at some later date. We begin with our opening words. The womb of the stars embraces us. Remnants of their fiery furnaces pulse through our veins. We are made of stardust, the dust of the explosions cast across space. We are of the earth. We breathe and live in the breath of ancient plants and animals. Their cells nourish the soil. We build our communities on their harvest of gifts. Our fingers trace curves carved in clay and stone by forebearers unknown to us. We are part of the great circle of humanity gathered around the fire, the hearth, and the altar. We gather anew this day to celebrate our common heritage, and we recall in gratitude all those things that have given us birth. Our chalice lighting. To face the world's coldness, we light a chalice of warmth. To face the world's terror, we light a chalice of courage. To face the world's turmoil, we light a chalice of peace. May its glow warm our hearts, our spirits, and our lives. And now we're going to stand and sing together our first hymn this morning, and it's hymn number 23, Bring Many Names, hymn number 23.
Thank you.
Let us pray. To pray is to stand under a heaven of stars, before a flower, a leaf in sunlight, or a grain of sand. To pray is to be silent, to be receptive before a tree astir with the wind or the passing shadow of a cloud. To pray is to work with dedication and with skill. It is to pause from work and to listen to a strain of music. To pray is to sing with the singing beauty of the earth. It is to listen through a storm until we hear the small, still voice within. To pray is to seek communion. Prayer is kindred fire within our hearts. It moves through deeds of kindness and through acts of love. Prayer is the mystery within us, reaching out to the mystery beyond. It is an inarticulate silence yearning to speak. It is the window of the moment, open to the sky of the eternal. Now let us say together the prayer Jesus taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Now we're going to start with our readers, and our first reader is Gavin.
Good morning. I'm going to read from a little book of Nordic wisdom called Free Loose Sleeve, which is finding your way home to nature, being in nature, not for an activity, but just to be there. Strengthen your connection. If you have ever shed sorrowful tears over the nagging feeling you don't belong on earth, that you are existentially lost, that the mothership left before beaming you back up, accept this tragic fact and adapt to your new environment. If no one has noticed you're missing by now, take advantage of the fact it may be a while before they come back for you. Every breath and every step offers an opportunity to connect or reconnect with where and who and what you are. Find comfort, the root of mood, in the fundamental foundations and essential elements that inspire you to establish contact. Explore them, and Earth will finally feel like home. The end of the rainbow. What lies at the end of the rainbow? Wouldn't you like to know? So go and find out and tell us all about it. Unless you find a pot of pay dirt piled high with leprechaunian liquid acids that may be worth something to someone someday. Unicorns, fairies, and gosh knows what else surely lurk invisible within the technicolor mist as rain and sun squabble for supremacy. And as you make your way through the refracted and dispersed light of enchanted lands, let mythical magic and fabled fairy tales guide you to your treasure, for what you seek is seeking you.
Tony Shine is our next reader.
Good morning, everybody. Took me a long time to find readings that I would use today. The books I have used before, and I didn't want to really repeat any of them. So I ended up using a book called A Book of 100 Poems by the name is escaping me. So he's famous. Was famous. One is, these are, I suppose, they're more secular, than most of what gets read here. But I'll go with them anyway. Seamus Heaney is the name. It comes back to me now. Two poems. And even then, going through these, it took me a long time to focus on these two. The first one, "A dog was crying tonight in Wicklow also, in memory of Donates Nuaga." This man was actually a very close friend of Heaney's. They, I think, did postgraduate work together in Belfast, and they remained in touch. And this, I think, was written on the occasion of Nuaga's death. "When human beings find out about death, they sent the dog to Chuwu with a message. They wanted to be led back to the house of life. They didn't want to end up lost forever, like burned wood disappearing into smoke, or ashes that get blown away to nothing. Instead, they saw their souls in a flock at twilight, cawing and headed back for the same old roosts and the same bright airs and wind stretching each morning. Death would be like a night spent in the wood. At first light, they'd be back in the house of life." The dog was meant to tell all this to Chuku. But death and human beings took second place when he trotted off the path and started barking at another dog in broad daylight, just barking back at him from the far bank of a river. And that is how the toad reached Chukwu first. The toad who'd overheard in the beginning what the dog was meant to tell. "Human beings," he said, and here the toad was trusted absolutely, "human beings want death to last forever." Then Chukwu saw the people's soul in birds, coming towards him like black spots off the sunset, to a place where there would be neither roosts nor trees, nor any way back to the house of life. And his mind reddened and darkened all at once. And nothing that the dog would tell him later could change that vision. Great chiefs and great loves in obliterated light, the toad in mud, the dog crying out all night behind the corpse house. And the second poem is maybe more familiar to people because Seamus Heaney himself used to read this on radio programs, and I think I've heard it being played several times since his death almost 9 years ago. It's called, its official title is Postscript. "And sometime make the time to drive out west into County Clare along the flaggy shore in September or October, when the wind and the light are working off each other so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter, and inland among the stones the surface of a slate-grey lake is lit by the earthed lightning of a flock of swans, their feathers ruffed and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown headstrong-looking heads tucked or cresting or busy underwater. Useless to think you'll park or capture it more thoroughly. You are neither here nor there. A hurry through which known and strange things pass as big soft buffetings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open."
Madeline.
Good morning. I was going to read you a very meaningful and deep poem, but I have managed to leave it at home. So Bridget has provided a book of readings that Bill Darlison used to use. So I've picked one of these, and it's the complete opposite to the poem I was going to read. So different people will like it, and I'll read the poem another time. Dear Dr. Laura, thank you for doing so much to educate people regarding God's law. I have learned a great deal from your show and try to share that knowledge with as many people as I can. When someone tries to defend the homosexual lifestyle, for example, I simply remind them that Leviticus 18:22 clearly states it to be an abomination. End of debate. I do need some advice from you, however, regarding some of the other specific laws and how to follow them. When I burn a bull on the altar as a sacrifice, I know it creates a pleasing odor for the Lord, Leviticus 1:9. The problem is my neighbors. They claim the odor is not pleasing to them. Should I smite them? I would like to sell my daughter into slavery as sanctioned in Exodus 21:7. In this day and age, what do you think would be a fair price for her? I know that I am allowed no contact with a woman while she is in her period of menstrual uncleanliness, Leviticus 15, 19:24. The problem is, how do I tell? I have tried asking, but most women take offense. Leviticus 25:44 states that I may indeed possess slaves, both male and female, provided they are purchased from neighboring nations. A friend of mine claims that this applies to Mexicans, but not Canadians. Can you clarify? Why can't I own Canadians? I have a neighbor who insists on working on the Sabbath. Exodus 35:2 clearly states he should be put to death. Am I morally obligated to kill him myself? A friend of mine feels that even though eating shellfish is an abomination, Leviticus 11:10, it is a lesser abomination than homosexuality. I don't agree. Can you settle this? Leviticus 21:20 states that I may not approach the altar of God if I have a defect in my sight. I have to admit that I wear reading glasses. Does my vision have to be 20/20, or is there some wiggle room here? Most of my male friends get their hair trimmed, including the hair around their temples, even though this is expressly forbidden by Leviticus 19:27. How should they die? I know from Leviticus 11:6-8 that touching the skin of a dead pig makes me unclean, but may I still play football if I wear gloves? My uncle has a farm. He violates Leviticus 19:19 by planting two different crops in the same field, as does his wife by wearing garments made of two different kinds of thread, cotton polyester blend. He also tends to curse and blaspheme a lot. Is it really necessary that we go to all the trouble of getting the whole town together to stone them? Leviticus 24. Couldn't we just burn them to death at a private family affair like we do with people who sleep with their in-laws? Leviticus 20. I know you have studied these things extensively, so I am confident you can help. Thank you again for reminding us that God's word is eternal and unchanging.
Denise.
Good morning, everyone. I don't have a reading. Instead, I was eavesdropping slightly, and I heard Dennis mention that too many people already knew it was his birthday yesterday. And I'm very sorry, Dennis. More people now know. We just wanted to wish Dennis a very happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Dennis. Happy birthday to you. Well, Dennis, I'd like to say that we're very lucky to have you. You have been a stalwart here in the church for as long as I've been coming and for a while before that. Bridget mentioned to me this morning that you were actually raised in the Church of Ireland community, but despite multiple interventions when you decided that wasn't right for you, you decided that here was right, and subsequently discovered, I think, that some of your predecessors had been very important in the church. But you are an absolute icon here for us, in that you have contributed so much, not just with your presence here almost every Sunday, with your warmth and your welcoming of those of us who come regularly and those of us who are visitors, but you also put your money where your mouth is, and you contribute to the church in so many ways, from being a member of the choir to the Damer and Singleton Trust to the managing committee, where I honestly don't know how any of us would get through meetings without you and your absolutely epic knowledge of the church and its history and our governance. And we are incredibly lucky to have you, and thank you for being part of our community, and we wish you a very happy birthday.
The children are going down with Denise, and Denise is taking them through a programme, and we're going to have a celebration of our young people on the first Sunday in June, the 5th of June. Put that in your diary. It'd be lovely to have the place full to celebrate our children, because you're really important in this place. And we usually tell the children a story, because it's nice to be told a story, and the adults even like it more than children. And this is a once upon a time story, and it's about the Buddha. Do you know what the Buddha looked like? He lived 2,500 years ago. Do you know, very often you see a figure with his legs crossed, really complicated crossed legs that none of us in the West can do? That's an image of the Buddha. And he was a very, very wise man. And he used to go from place to place talking to people and sharing some wisdom with them. And he went to a town, and in this town there was a man who was blind, and he'd always been blind from birth. And people were always trying to explain to this blind man what light was like. And he never believed them, didn't believe them. He used to say, "You tell me there's something, I can't see it there, and I just don't believe it." And he used to say, "Look, I can touch things, I can hear, I can taste, I can smell. I can't touch light, I can't taste it, I can't smell it, I can't hear it." And people still say, "But there is something else, we just can't explain it to you." So when the Buddha came to their town, they thought, "We'll ask the Buddha to explain to this man what light is." Do you think the Buddha succeeded? Kevin's saying no. Any reason why, Kevin?
The guy was really, he sounded really defiant on light.
He was sort of, he'd made up his own mind that there wasn't. Michael was nodding yes.
I don't know why.
You don't know why. You just think that the Buddha was so wise that we're still talking about him, so he must have been able to explain it. What the Buddha said was, "I wouldn't even meet this man. What you need to do with this man is bring him to an optician and an eye specialist and see, can he get sight back?" And the people thought, "Oh, that's a good idea." And it's what they did. And it worked. The man could see. And by this stage, the Buddha had left town. But the man went to talk to him and went to thank him and to say to him, "You know, that was a great idea. It's great to be able to see. And the people were all right. But why didn't you try to explain it to me that they were right?" And the Buddha said, "No one else can explain mystery to other people." And very often in religions, people try to give other people their version of wisdom, of God, of the great mysteries of life. And we can't do it. However, when we get the light ourselves, there's no need to explain. Thank you, children. Denise is going to take you downstairs now, and we're going to have our second hymn, number 92, Mysterious Presence.
Thank you.
Now to share his wisdom with us, we have Dennis.
I must just say that after that, in all my 55 years of being a member of this congregation, I think you're the most fantastic group of people. And I don't know why it is, but there's something very special about this church. After Madeline's reading, this is also from the Old Testament, but it's serious stuff. And it's the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 8. Most of the passages from the Old Testament have God hands-on directing every move of human beings. And if you didn't obey his instructions, the penalties were laid down, usually at the end of the passage, with dire consequences. And this is no exception. And the scene is the children of Israel have arrived at the River Jordan, and they are about to proceed over into the promised land, the land of Canaan. And these are God's final instructions. All the commandments which I command thee this day shall ye observe to do, that ye may live and multiply and go in and possess the land which the Lord sware unto your fathers. And thou shalt remember all the way which the Lord thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble thee and to prove thee and to know what was in thine heart, whether thou would keep his commandments or no. And he humbled thee and suffered thee to hunger and fed thee with manna which thou knewest not, neither did thy fathers know, that he might make thee know that man doth not live by bread only, but by the every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God doth man live. Thy raiment waxed not old upon thee, neither did thy foot swell these 40 years. Thou shalt consider in thine heart that as a man chasteneth his son, so the Lord thy God chasteneth thee. Therefore, thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord thy God, to walk in his ways and to fear him. For the Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and depths that spring out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of oil, olive, and honey, a land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness. Thou shalt not lack anything in it. A land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills thou mayest dig brass. When thou hast eaten and art full, thou shalt bless the Lord thy God for the good land which he hath given thee. Beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God in not keeping his commandments and his judgments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, lest when thou hast eaten and art full, and hast built goodly houses and dwelt therein, and when thy herds and thy flocks multiply, and thy silver and thy gold is multiplied, and all that thou hast is multiplied, then thy heart be lifted up, and thou forget the Lord thy God, which brought thee forth out of the house of bondage, out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, who led thee through that great and terrible wilderness, wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water, who brought thee forth water out of the rock of flint, who fed thee in the wilderness with manna which thy fathers knew not, that he might humble thee and that he might prove thee to do thee good at thy latter end. And thou say in thine heart, my power and the might of mine hand hath gotten me this wealth. But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto thy fathers, as it is this day. And it shall be, if thou do at all forget the Lord thy God, and walk after other gods, and serve them, and worship them, I testify against you this day that ye shall surely perish, as the nations which the Lord destroyeth before your face, so shall ye perish, because ye would not be obedient unto the voice of the Lord your God. Stern words from the book of Deuteronomy.
Janet is our next reader.
Good morning, everybody. For my favourite reading this morning, I was lucky enough to come across a book titled The Poetry Pharmacy, and it's by a gentleman known as William Seagart. And in this book, he has prescribed poetry for different conditions. Today's condition that he is prescribing for is the need for gratitude, or the need for mindfulness, or a sense of disconnection. And the poem he is prescribing is a wonderful poem by Mary Oliver, and it's titled Praying. He just has a few lines as a way of introducing the poem. Prayer, to many in our secular age, has become a rather dirty word. The concept is dismissed as fusty or naive. The practice even more so. And yet, as the popularity of meditation and mindfulness soars, there seems to be a collective longing for a moment of quiet in our busy lives. A moment in which another voice, an internal whisper, all too easily drowned out behind the sirens and chatter of modern life, may speak. Mark Oakley, a former canon at St. Paul's Cathedral in London, wrote a wonderful book about how, to him, liturgy was poetry. Across religions, he says, the devotional words which we chant, memorize, or sing are a kind of poetry that links us to the divine. In the case of many religions, those words can be in a language that the worshippers themselves don't even understand. And yet somehow, their cadence is enough to transport us. It's not only the religious who can gain from prayer, just as it's not only the religious who can appreciate a spectacular cathedral, a mosque, or a temple. Prayer is a constant that runs through all human civilizations, and it's there for a reason. In this poem, Mary Oliver reminds us that we are all in need of a doorway into thanks and gratitude, and a way of relating to the world without our egos. Having found that, we can allow ourselves, even if only for a moment, to feel a quiet gratitude for all the small moments of grace that we encounter daily. We can thank the world around us for containing blue irises and weeds and small stones. Stop in the street, in the garden, on the train. Pay attention. Put together a few simple words that feel right. If you're quiet and very lucky, you might just hear a voice whispering back to you. Praying by Mary Oliver. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot, or a few small stones. Just pay attention. Then patch a few words together, and don't try to make them elaborate. This is not a contest, but the doorway into thanks, and a silence in which another voice may speak.
Andy.
Following Bridget's children's story, I'm going to read a passage from the great religious scholar Karen Armstrong's book on the Buddha. Modern New Testament scholarship has shown that we know far less about the historical Jesus than we thought we did. Gospel truth is not as watertight as we assumed. But this has not prevented millions of people from modeling their lives on Jesus and seeing his path of compassion and suffering as leading to a new kind of life. Jesus certainly existed, but his story has been presented in the Gospels as a paradigm. Christians have looked back to him when delving into the heart of their own problems. Indeed, it is only possible to comprehend Jesus fully if one has, in some sense, experienced personal transformation. The same is true of the Buddha, who until the 20th century was probably one of the most influential figures of all time. His teaching flourished in India for 1,500 years and then spread to Tibet, Central Asia, China, Korea, Japan, Sri Lanka, and Southeast Asia. For millions of human beings, he has been the person who has epitomized the human situation. Many aspects of the Buddha's quest will appeal to the modern ethos. His scrupulous empiricism is especially congenial to the pragmatic tenor of our own Western culture, together with his demand for intellectual and personal independence. Those who find the idea of a supernatural God alien will also warm to the Buddha's refusal to affirm a supreme being. He confined his researches to his own human nature and always insisted that his experiences, even the supreme truth of nirvana, meaning the extinction of self, which brings enlightenment and liberation from pain, were entirely natural to humanity. Those who have become weary of the intolerance of some forms of institutional religiosity will also welcome the Buddha's emphasis on compassion and loving kindness. But the Buddha is also a challenge because he is more radical than most of us. There is a creeping new orthodoxy in modern society that is sometimes called positive thinking. At its worst, this habit of optimism allows us to bury our heads in the sand, deny the ubiquity of pain in ourselves and others, and to immure ourselves in a state of deliberate heartlessness to ensure our emotional survival. The Buddha would have had little time for this. In his view, the spiritual life cannot begin until people allow themselves to be invaded by the reality of suffering. Realize how fully it permeates our whole experience and feel the pain of all other beings, even those whom we do not find congenial. It is also true that most of us are not prepared for the degree of the Buddha's self-abandonment. We know that egotism is a bad thing. We know that all the great world traditions, not just Buddhism, urge us to transcend our selfishness. But when we seek liberation in either a religious or a secular guise, we really want to enhance our own sense of self. A good deal for what passes for religion is often designed to prop up and endorse the ego that the founders of the faith told us to abandon. We assume that a person like the Buddha, who has apparently and after a great struggle vanquished all selfishness, will become inhuman, humorless, and grim. Yet that does not seem to have been true of the Buddha. He may have been impersonal, but the state he achieved inspired an extraordinary emotion in all who met him. The constant, even relentless degree of gentleness, fairness, equanimity, impartiality, and serenity acquired by the Buddha touch a chord and resonate with some of our deepest yearnings. People were not repelled by his dispassionate calm, not daunted by his lack of preference for one thing, one person over another. Instead, they were drawn to the Buddha and flocked to him. When people committed themselves to the regimen that he prescribed for suffering humanity, they said that they took refuge with the Buddha. He was a haven of peace in a violent world of clamorous egotism.
Our final reader is Shari.
Well, you know, our former minister, Bill Darlison, used to talk about serendipity. And I think the serendipitous connections between today's readings is quite remarkable. So I can't help recalling that. I'm just going to read something that I woke up saying to myself this morning, which is the Magnificat, the Song of Mary. And just a few minor comments about this, which I picked up from a commentary that was written in 1961 by James Forstall. And I think when you hear the commentary, you'll understand why it particularly resonates with me. First of all, the Magnificat is part of a Jewish tradition, a pre-New Testament tradition of songs to the Lord. So it's very much in keeping with the Old Testament Psalms. It contains a lot of themes and phrases that harken back to the Psalms, but it's not just a pastiche of Old Testament texts. In fact, Forstall says, Mary's Magnificat has always been recognized to reflect the Old Testament in almost every phrase. Some have even suggested that it is simply a mosaic of Old Testament citations, but that's not really, to his thinking, the case. Part of the tradition in the Old Testament, the Magnificat is also part of the tradition in the Old Testament of the salvation of the poor and the afflicted by God. It's very much in that thread of looking to God to save the poor and the afflicted. It's also about the salvation of Israel, but not the geographical location of Israel, not the nation of Israel, but as Forstall says, the people of God, that is, the people of the Spirit. In this sense, it's suggested that the salvation referred to is the salvation of the soul, and that is the salvation of the poor in spirit, as in the sayings. In incorporating this Song of Mary into the New Testament, the author creates a link between Jesus' story and the Messiah envisaged in the Old Testament. And the suggestion, of course, is that Jesus' story is the fulfillment of the Old Testament messianic vision. Now, this is very relevant. I woke up singing this and in my head, and I think it's because it's very relevant today in a number of ways. One is the fact that we've come through, we hope, the worst of the pandemic, certainly a very bad period of time. And so there is the gratitude in the Magnificat is very fitting, as were other gratitudes that were spoken of this morning. I think it's also relevant to the financial crisis that we're now facing into and those who will be suffering at this time and facing into privation and looking for some relief from that. And of course, it's quite relevant for someone like myself who comes from the Jewish tradition and now participates in the Christian tradition to align myself with the Magnificat, which brings those two together. And Mary said, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has looked with favor on the lowly state of his servant. Surely from now on all generations will call me blessed. For the Mighty One has done great things for me, and holy is his name. Indeed, his mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. He has come to the aid of his child Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise he made to our ancestors, to Abraham, and to his descendants forever.
Now, after all those words, we're going to have a prayer and then some time of silence. It will be brought to an end by a piece of music. This prayer was written by a young woman called Etty Hillesum. She died in a concentration camp in 1942, and she was only 29 years old when she died. And before she went to the concentration camp, she became involved in searching for God. And this is what she wrote for a prayer. God, take me by your hand, and I shall follow you dutifully and not resist too much. I shall evade none of the tempests life has in store for me. I shall try to face it all as best I can. But now and then, grant me a short respite. I shall never again assume in my innocence that any peace that comes my way will be eternal. I shall accept all the inevitable tumult and struggle. I delight in warmth and security, but I shall not rebel if I have to suffer cold, should you so decree. I shall follow where your hand leads me and shall try not to be afraid. I shall try to spread some of my warmth and my genuine love for others wherever I go. But we shouldn't boast of our love for others. We cannot be sure that it really exists. I don't want to be anything special. I only want to be true to that in me which seeks to fulfill its promise. I sometimes imagine that I long for the seclusion of a nunnery, but I know that I must seek you among people out in the world. Our notices before our final hymn. First of all, I'm sure our visitors are wondering why we didn't show our appreciation for the music. We don't do it during the service, but we do certainly do it at the notices. Thank you so much, Shari and Roland. It was absolutely lovely. They will play the final piece of that sonata after the blessing. There's no offertory, but there is a box on the way out if people would like to make a donation. And it's also possible to make a donation to the church from our website. There's a few copies of Uskell's magazine for May on the table. There are copies of the Inquirer and the Non-Subscribing Presbyterian. Your charity act can be to give them one of those magazines a home. From June onwards, we're getting more back to normal. There will be an offertory taken during the services. And then from July onwards, we should have our Damer Hall back, and we'll be back to having tea and coffee and chat after the services. On Sunday the 5th of June, we're having what we call a junior coming of age for the young people who were in church this morning. It's a celebration for them, a special day, a day to make them feel special. They are part of our community, and lots of their friends are making First Holy Communions, so it's a nice way to mark their passing years. There are a few plants downstairs. I'm going to bring them up and I'll bring them home, but if anyone wants to adopt a plant on the way home, they're very welcome to one. Our final hymn this morning is the lovely hymn, Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee. Here. Mary, apologies. I'll just announce it. You can be opening hymn book at page 29. Come on, Mary.
Just a quick request. So the refugee group in the church here works very closely with the Irish Refugee Council, and they have a request for a young Afghan teenager. He's 18 years of age, who is doing his leaving cert in Palmerstown in June. And because he's 18, by Tuesday he's considered to be an adult, and they would just put him into a hotel or whatever accommodation, shared accommodation, which would not be suitable. They're looking for a place for this young man, a room or whatever, just a place to stay for 2, max 3 months while he completes his leaving cert. So we're looking for somewhere in the Palmerstown area or on a bus route to Palmerstown. And while you may not have a place, people whom you know may have a place. So spread the word and please contact me, or Bridget will pass on my contact details as well, and I'll put you in touch with the IRC. So that's for an 18-year-old young Afghan man doing his leaving cert, looking for accommodation. Thank you.
We now have our final hymn, Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee.